Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so today's sutta is Majjhima number 28. It was apparently suggested by somebody by email to Ajahn Brahma. So that's why this one. It's a fairly involved sutta. It's not very straightforward. So for those of you who are coming for the first time, I feel don't give up. If you don't understand everything that's going on, don't feel sort of disheartened or anything. Because this is one of the most involved suttas in the entire Majjhima Nikaya, I think. So it's quite it's a bit of a bit complex, basically. Okay, so we'll just start off. The Majjhima 28, page 278 in the middle length sayings. The greater discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati, in Jeta's grove, and at Apindika's park. There, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Friends, bhikkhus," "Friend," they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. Venerable Sariputta, of course, is the Buddha's right-hand disciple. And he was said to be the one who could keep the teaching rolling, even if the Buddha himself didn't teach the Dhamma. He was said that he could keep rolling the Dhamma on his own because of his profound wisdom. Friends, just as the footprint of any living being that walks can be placed within an elephant's footprint, and so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them because of its great size, so too all wholesome states can be included in the Four Noble Truths. In what four? In the noble truth of suffering, in the noble truth of the origin of suffering, in the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and in the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay, so first of all here, this translation here, I must admit, I don't like it at all. It says that so too all wholesome states can be included in the Four Noble Truths. And I don't really understand what that means. And I think that's it's not a good translation. I think what it should say there is that all good teachings, or all skillful teachings, or all wholesome teachings, if you like, are included in the Four Noble Truths. That is, I think, is a more appropriate translation there. Because a wholesome state is a fairly sort of ambiguous what that actually means. So all good teachings can be included in the Four Noble Truths, I think is a better translation in this particular case. And what that means, of course, is that it makes the Four Noble Truths a very eminent kind of teaching. And that is why I think often the Four Noble Truths are considered at the pinnacle, in a sense, of the Buddha's teachings. As if they encompass everything else that he said. And this is one particular case where this seems to be spelled out in detail, this particular fact, that this is the pinnacle of all his teachings, which includes everything else. And of course, then you have the standard description of the Four Noble Truths in brief after that. And then he picks out one of these Noble Truths. And what is the Noble Truth of suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. So that is the standard definition of the Noble Truth of suffering. I'm not going to go into details on this one because it's not really a central part of the discourse. And then he picks out one statement among those statements on the Noble Truth of suffering. You see, he goes down into more and more refined detail here on individual points. And what are the five aggregates affected by clinging? They are the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging here. So the five aggregates there, the way of dividing, if you like, a living being, standard Buddhist way of dividing a living being into physical and mental components, the five aggregates. And then he takes out one of these aggregates, so again subdividing even more, further and further down, so to speak. And what is the material form aggregate affected by clinging here? It is the four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements. And what are the four great elements? They are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Okay, so he has taken out the form aggregate and says that the form aggregate is divided up into the four elements. And this was a standard way at the time of the Buddha of dividing material form into these four categories. And the Buddha used it as well. And the point here is not whether this is an accurate way of describing reality. It's not as if you can compare this to atoms and quarks and this sort of thing. That's not really the point. The point is that it's a useful way of looking at matter, to actually investigate it and then help you with insight practice and also with samadhi practice. That's really the point here. And then he also says the four great elements and material form derived from the four great elements. So this is usually said to be things like hearing or sight or even visual forms or sound. These things are like the nose, the ability to smell and smells and tastes and the tongue, the ability to taste. All of these things are said to be included in a material form which is derived from the four great elements. And this is important here because we come back to the sense bases later on. And then the Buddha subdivides further and he goes down to the earth element. And not the Buddha, sorry, Venerable Sariputta. And he says, what, friends, is the earth element? And this, now we really start with the discourse proper, so to speak. He has divided everything down to the most refined level, and then he talks about this, about the earth element. So what, friends, is the earth element? The earth element may be either internal or external. What is the internal earth element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. That is, head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. The earth element is basically whatever is solid. That's basically what the earth element means. And there's a couple of interesting points here. And you will notice at the very beginning there, he says that the earth element is whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. It's interesting here, this idea of clung to is added there. Because what that means is that if it is not clung to, then it is not the internal earth element anymore, because clung to is part of the definition there. And of course, what that means is that it becomes internal because we cling to it. That's how it becomes separate from external earth elements, through an act of clinging. So somebody who doesn't cling like an arahat, he doesn't actually see a distinction, or she doesn't see a distinction between the internal and the external earth element. Why is that? Well, because you have given up clinging. There is no distinction anymore between this body and external bodies. Everything is just earth element. If this body isn't mine, that's what the arahat has given up, the idea that this body is mine, that this is I. Then it becomes unmine, if you like, as any other kind of material form outside. So the distinction between internal and external has has actually disappeared for the arahat. That's the first thing here, which is the point here. Yes, you have. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's everything is kind of, there is a gradation there of me and not me, right? So if you cut off the leg straight away, you might think, oh, it's mine, you want to hold on to it. But after a while, it occurs to you that actually, I got to give this up. I can't hold on to a leg which is cut off. Unless you have it sewn on again, it becomes yours again. So it's really, it's a mental game, isn't it? This clinging here. It depends on your mind state, basically, how you look at it. But for the arahat, even though he is able to see this body as it is, in one sense, it is his in the sense that he will obviously use it in whatever way it is appropriate to use the body. Yeah. But in another way, he's completely mentally detached from it. Yeah. He will still feel the feeling of having cut the leg off. He will still feel pain, but he won't identify with it. So if he cuts the leg off, it doesn't matter. You know, it's not a big deal. It doesn't mean that he wants to have it cut off. He doesn't want to because it becomes awkward, becomes difficult to move around, and it's painful. But if it happens, he doesn't identify with it. You see? Make sense? Yeah. Okay. We'll see. Well, if you become more clear, just bring it up again if you like. Okay, so this is what makes it internal, the fact that we cling to it. Take away the clinging, and all earth element is just earth element. There's no distinction anymore. And the other important point here, of course, is that you see how it is divided up. It's divided up into all these little parts. And the point of this, point of dividing it up in this way, is that as soon as we divide up the earth element, or we divide up the body into parts, it becomes much less personal suddenly. For example, if you take things like the bone marrow, or the intestines, or the mesentery, we don't really identify so much with those things. We don't sort of think, oh, that's my spleen. It doesn't really matter so much anymore. And of course, that is very helpful if you want to learn to disidentify with the body, is to divide it up in such a way whereby these parts become disimpersonalized, if you like. And, you know, things like the head hairs, for example, once you take one head hair and you pull it out, or you see it gets cut off at the barber, or you take the skin and you see how the skin sometimes comes off the body, how it always is peeling to some extent, and nails get cut off. And so even these things which are like external markers, which we identify more with, when we look at them more closely, we see that in reality they just belong to nature. They just go their own way. And we cannot hold on to these things. Eventually they will fall out, eventually they will wear out. And it's a process of continuous falling away. So it's like a skillful means, instead of taking the whole body as the earth element, because we identify so much with the whole body, we pull it apart instead and look at its parts, and then it becomes more easy to disidentify with these parts. So, and then Venerable Sariputta goes on here. He says, now both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. So, the point here is that if you start looking at how this body originates and what happens to it, you know that the body originates through material food. It gets built up by eating, by drinking, by whatever. And you know that there's parts coming off all the time throughout your life. There are hair falling out and skin coming off and all these kind of things. It's always changing. And of course, when you die, you know that the body goes back to nature. So the body comes from nature. It is sustained by nature. And then it goes back to nature when you die again. It's very obvious when you think about it that this body actually belongs to nature. It's not any different from nature in its reality. And this is what it means here when Venerable Sariputta says that the internal earth element and the external earth element are the same. There is no distinction between these things. Just a temporary coming together of a few things, and then it all dissolves again. And when you, the more you realize that, obviously the more you are not going to try to hold on to this. If this body belongs to nature, then there's no point in trying to hold on to it and control it, because there cannot be any control of something which doesn't belong to you. It belongs to nature, and that's where it's going to go back to as soon as you pass away. So the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. They are the same. There is no distinction there. And of course, this is why when somebody becomes an arahat, is that they realize this fully. And if you realize that the internal and external are the same, of course, that distinction also disappears, as I was saying before. There's actually a powerful reflection here. It's very, very strong. And I think it can be very useful to gain some sense of dispassion and towards the body sometimes. And then he says, and that should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. So, of course, once you understand that the internal and the external earth element are the same, well, of course, it can't be yours anymore, because you, it's not as if all the earth element everywhere is yours. If they are the same, then clearly there is no me and there is no mine in this anymore. It's just nature taking its course, nature coming temporarily together. You have some control over the earth element or your body while you're alive. But generally speaking, it goes according to its own nature. It becomes sick or ages and then dies eventually. And there's nothing much you can do about it, except feeding it occasionally and taking it to the toilet, etc. So when you see this, when you understand this fully, that the external and the internal are the same, then the proper wisdom should arise. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And of course, when you see that it isn't yourself, then you actually become disenchanted, they say here, with the earth element. Another translation for this word called nibbida is that, maybe a more literal translation, is that you become repelled by the earth element. You used to, there's a simile in the suttas for this word which talks about if you hold a feather of a bird up against the fire, the feather tends to turn away from the fire. It actually, there is a repulsion there from the fire. And because of that simile, I think repulsion or being repelled is actually a good translation for that word. And of course, the reason that you become repelled is because you have been holding on to this earth element throughout your life. You have been clinging on to it. And suddenly now you see, understand for the first time, it's got nothing to do with me. I can't control this. If I can't control it, then I cannot ensure that it always will bring happiness towards me. Sometimes it's going to bring suffering, sometimes happiness, but the reality is I don't really have any control over it. At that point, you lose all interest because you realize it's going to bring you suffering and it's going to bring you all kinds of difficulties. So you become repelled. And when you become repelled, then eventually that leads to the mind becoming dispassionate. In other words, you get repelled initially, and eventually you realize that you just have to leave it aside completely, neither cling to it nor try to control it, and you get to a stage of dispassion, where basically dispassion means you don't have an interest in it anymore, right? The opposite of passion, the opposite of desire, you don't have any interest in the earth element anymore. Okay, so that is what happens if you do this contemplation properly. And the phrase here, that one should see something with as it actually is with proper wisdom, usually that is a reference to becoming a stream enterer. So usually, at this point, it may already be that this person who does this fully has actually become a stream enterer. Stream enterer, of course, somebody who has seen the Dhamma, somebody who has understood what the Dhamma is all about, and is bound for enlightenment. But, as usual, even though in its highest sense it probably refers to the stream enterer, in a lower level it's obviously also applicable to everybody else, even though you haven't reached that attainment yet. Okay, so that is the introductory part there on the earth element. A very powerful stuff. Very interesting, actually, the way it is presented here, I find it. Anyway, now there comes a time when the water element is disturbed, and then the external earth element vanishes. When even this external earth element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and changed, what of this body, which is clung to by craving, and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I, or mine, or I am. So the point here is simply to say that even the external earth element, even all the earth, all the solidity around us everywhere, is essentially impermanent. So if all the solidity around us impermanent, well, surely the body of ours is much more so impermanent than everything else. And exactly what this means, that the water element is disturbed, I'm not sure whether that means like if there's a big flood or something, or what it means. I think you can relate this almost like to things like the big crunch. You know, you have the Big Bang, and then some physicists believe that there's also a big crunch when the whole universe disappears. That is certainly a time when the great earth element vanishes. The point here is really just to show that even the external element vanishes. So what about this tiny body in comparison? So then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu, a monk, who has seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus, this painful feeling born of ear contact has arisen in me. That is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. Okay? So he understands that the painful feeling born of ear contact is obviously here a reference to him being scolded and abused, right? He gets scolded and abused, and that is painful. And then he reflects that, well, this painful feeling is dependent, not independent, and is dependent on contact. And the point here is that contact in Buddhism, and we'll see this later on in the same sutta, contact depends on three things. Contact is a coming together in the suttas of the ear, the object, the sound that is, and also consciousness. So when you have consciousness, and you have the ear, and you have sound coming together, that is contact, those three. At that point, you actually hear something. How this relates to the previous paragraph is that, remember what I said, that as mentioned briefly, that material form derived from the four great elements. Now, the ear and sound are material form derived from the four great elements. So, what that means is that ear contact is dependent on material form. Right? So, what he's seeing here is that this ear contact, this painful ear contact, which has arisen in me, depends on material form, depends on this earth element, which I have understood to be impermanent, non-self, subject to destruction, etc. So, because he understands that the painful feeling born of ear contact is dependent on the earth element, it is dependent. And put for that reason, it is impermanent as well. Just as the earth element is impermanent, so must this feeling born of ear contact also be impermanent. They go together. And that is how that links up to the previous paragraph, which otherwise is a bit difficult to understand, maybe, why suddenly this comes up. So it's dependent on contact. Then he sees that contact is impermanent. And contact is impermanent, as I said, because form is impermanent. Because contact depends on form, or rather the earth element, if you like. So that contact is impermanent, that feeling is impermanent, that perception is impermanent, that formations are impermanent, and that consciousness is impermanent. This is what he sees. Because contact is impermanent due to form, due to the earth element being impermanent, then the feeling which arises, the painful feeling, also must be impermanent. Because that painful feeling is dependent on what you hear, right? Now, together with that feeling, there is also a particular perception. Perception also goes with feeling. So that perception is also impermanent, because that perception depends on that ear contact. Formations, it's difficult to translate this word, it's not really meant as a criticism of the translator, but more, it's very hard to really understand what this word means from that translation. It's better to call it will or volition, or the doer, basically. Sankara is the word here in the Pali. So this doer is impermanent, and that consciousness is impermanent. So these are all the mental factors which are associated with that moment of hearing when you hear that painful thing. The feeling is a painful feeling. The perception is a perception of hearing something painful. The formations is that desire or will to actually hear that particular thing, whatever it is, in the first place. And the consciousness is the consciousness which is associated with that hearing as well. So because the ear contact is impermanent, all those mental factors which are associated with that ear contact, they will also have to be impermanent. All of these things go together. So you may wonder, is it really necessary to think in this way? Because when I first read this, I thought, well, obviously that being scolded and harassed and reviled is impermanent. That makes, and everybody should know that. Is it really necessary to go through this kind of elaborate analysis to understand that this is impermanent? It seems a bit over the top. I think the point is that very often when we get into that situation and something happens to us, at that moment, that feeling actually tends to appear very permanent. The moment when we feel something happening to us, something painful or happy, there's a sense of permanence about it. And one way to look at that, which is quite persuasive for some people at least, is that sometimes if people get depressed, they end up committing suicide because of that depression. And the reason is because of the sense, the feeling inside that this is the way it is now. It's permanent. I can't change this thing anymore. The sensation that this depression I have is somehow very almost there to stay. It's part of your personality, part of who you are. You can't let go of it anymore. So because of that, you feel it's almost like it's permanent. And I was reading some psychology report somewhere about exactly the same thing. And they were saying that, generally speaking, human beings tend to think that the feeling they have now is permanent. This is the way I am. So when you get happy, you tend to get carried away by it. Yes, I found the solution. This is the way it is to be happy. And then, not long afterwards, of course, it disappears again, and you wonder, how could that happen? I thought I had the solution to happiness. And the same thing with depression. You get sad and depressed, and you can't pull yourself out anymore because you think it is permanent. And of course, the thing which lies behind all that is this sense of self that we have inside. And because we tend to think that the mental state I have now, because we have the idea of a self, this mental state that we have now, then becomes a foundation for that self-view. And that's why we find it difficult to understand how things can change, precisely because we have this idea of a self, something being permanent inside. And feelings is part of this thing that we take to be a self. So once you have a feeling, you will tend to think it's impermanent because of the delusion of a self. So that is why I think it is analyzed in this way, because this analysis, if you understand this and see this properly, particularly if you become a sotapanna, a stream enterer, then you will have understood this dependent relationship so profoundly that it is impossible anymore that you should take any feeling, any earth element, any of these five khandhas as being permanent. So that is my understanding of that passage there. As I said, this is not a very straightforward or simple sutta. And so he goes on then, and his mind, having made an element its objective support, enters into that new objective support and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. Okay, I have retranslated that a little bit. And his mind, using an element as its meditation subject, then enters into that element and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. So the element we're talking about here is, of course, the earth element that we saw on top of the page that we're talking about. So he uses that earth element to reflect in this way. And when that reflection is successful, then he acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution, and the mind enters into, so to speak, that subject, which is that element we're just talking about. And these words here, enter into, acquire confidence, steadiness, and resolution, these are words which are associated with samadhi in the Pali suttas. So essentially what he's doing here, he's giving up the defilements, the mind is becoming purified, he's letting go, and he is acquiring samadhi. And the samadhi that he is acquiring here is a samadhi which is, of course, based on reflection, based on wisdom, based on insight, if you like. So by reflecting wisely and by using insight properly, it will always tend to lead towards samadhi. You probably heard Ajahn Brahm say that many times, that insight and samatha, calm and insight, they always go hand in hand. So if you have a profound insight, if you have a good understanding of something, you will tend to become calm because of that. And if you are calm, it's only then that you will tend to have profound insights. And this is what you're seeing here. You're seeing that the insight gives rise to calm. Okay. Does anybody have any questions, or everybody happy? Yes. It is almost synonymous in the suttas, I would say, because if you read the suttas, you will see that samadhi, rather jhana, occurs almost everywhere. It's such a common thing. You see it all the time. Sometimes samadhi is used without any specification, just says samadhi, doesn't actually say what it means. But because the jhanas are by far the most important samadhi in the suttas, all other samadhis are so minor compared to jhanas, I would say that usually, if it just says samadhi, it refers to jhanas. Well, that category is a commentarial category. You find it in the commentaries. It's not actually a category which you find in the suttas at all. And so it is. So the validity of that distinction is already a little bit questionable, particularly Kanika Samadhi, which is a very strange idea, because Kanika is momentary, and Samadhi is sustained attention. So it's a rather strange combination to have sustained attention combined with momentary. It's a bit weird. But there is some justification for Upachara Samadhi from the suttas, because they talk about Samadhi which arises before you enter jhanas, for example. Or you can even say Upachara Samadhi is the samadhi you have when you come out of jhanas. There's still a sense of concentration there. So there is some truth to that. But the point is that when you look at the suttas and you look at the different types of samadhi which are described, and you have many different types, there are things called animita samadhi and sunyata samadhi. There's samadhi associated with satipatthana, there's samadhi with walking meditation. There's many different types you come across in the suttas. But there's one type which you see all the time, and that is the jhanas. So because you see that all the time, if you're going to decide what samadhi means in a particular case, you're going to have to say, chances are, 95% certain, it means the jhanas. Okay? So you just have to go by probability and see what is actually the Buddha talks about, mostly. Yes? Okay. Yeah, I just said, instead of this translation, which I find is a bit obscure, I just said, and his mind, using an element as its meditation subject, or as a subject of reflection, he enters into that element and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution in it. Okay, so I'll move on to the next section here. And we're still talking about the earth element. Almost 40 minutes already, okay. Okay, now, if others attack that monk in ways that are unwished for, undesired and disagreeable, by contact with fists, clods, sticks, or knives, he understands thus, this body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. So the point here is simply that the body, having already been shown to be partly be made of the earth element, and the earth element, of course, we have seen has certain characteristics. But once you have a body, then you can expect that occasionally fists and clods and sticks and knives might assail you. You might get attacked. You might get somebody might do something to you. And the reason for that is simply because that's the nature of the body. The body is an element which can be contacted and assailed in these various ways. So because the body can be attacked in these ways, then occasionally it will, hopefully pretty rarely, but occasionally these things might happen. So we shouldn't be too surprised if somebody gives us a blow, I suppose. That's part and parcel of having a body, that these things happen, unfortunately. But then this monk reflects further, but this has been said by the Blessed One in his advice on the simile of the saw. The simile of the saw occurs a few suttas before, Majjhima 21, I think it is. Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Very famous saying by the Buddha, which is very often quoted, and it's even quoted here in the suttas. So even if somebody takes a two-handed saw and starts to cut you up into pieces, still you shouldn't have hate towards them. It's pretty, very high, kind of high ideals here. So because of that, thinking like that, then what happens? Then tireless energy shall be aroused in me, an unremitting mindfulness established. My body shall be tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. Of course, if you're going to have that sort of ideal established in you, that you are not going to give rise to any anger or irritation, even if somebody cuts you up with a two-handled saw, then obviously you're going to have these qualities established in your mind. Tireless energy, powerful mindfulness and concentration. If you haven't got that, there is no way that you will be able to withstand that sort of attack on you. You are going to get angry and upset if somebody does that. So that's why he's saying here, I will give rise to these things, so I can withstand this. And now, once I have given rise to these things, let contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail this body, for this is just how the Buddha's teaching is practiced. In other words, he is ready. If somebody wants to give him a blow, he's obviously not going to seek it out, but if somebody wants to give him a blow, then he's not afraid anymore, he's not concerned, because his mind is so strong that he knows he can deal with it. When that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, if equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, then he arouses a sense of urgency thus. It is a loss for me, it is no gain for me, it is bad for me, it is no good for me, that when I thus recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in me. So the recollection of the Buddha here, he just recalled the teaching by the Buddha, right? The teaching by the Buddha that you should not give rise to anger, even if you get sawn to pieces. That's the recollection of the Buddha. And the recollection of the Dhamma is the recollection of that particular teaching. And the recollection of the Sangha is presumably those who practice that way. So when he recollects the triple gem in this way, if equanimity is supported by the wholesome, because he is thinking and reflecting in a wholesome way, in a good way, so it's equanimity supported by the wholesome. If it does not become established, then he arouses a sense of urgency, which basically means that he practices even harder to try to establish these things. I think the reason why we have equanimity here is basically that you're not to ask to have loving kindness or compassion for people who cut you up by a two-handled saw might be asking too much for most people. So if you can at least establish equanimity in that situation, that is the ideal, I suppose. We don't want to push the ideal too far with loving kindness or compassion, but at least equanimity towards those people. Okay. Yeah. I think you can do it, but I think that's true. But I think in the sense that actually seeing that with a disease is probably easier in one way, because a disease is something impersonal. Right. I think what he's saying is that not so much that you shouldn't fight it, but that you shouldn't give rise to ill will and hatred and anger. So you can fight it. But make sure that you do it in a good way. You can take hospital treatment, you can do things. You can think, what is the best strategy for getting rid of this disease? But don't get upset about it, don't get angry about it. So I think with a disease, it's probably a little bit easier than it is with people. Because with people, you always have the sense there is an agent there behind it, purposely attacking you. But whereas with a disease, it's more like, well, it's just nature taking its course, so to speak. But you're right. No, I think it's probably that's a good preparation in a sense for this sort of thing, is that you start with the easy ones and make sure you don't have any hostility towards the disease. Okay. So he then goes on with a simile. Just as when a daughter-in-law sees her father-in-law, she arouses a sense of urgency to please him. So too, when that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, if equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, then he arouses a sense of urgency. But if, when he recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome becomes established in him, then he is satisfied with it. At that point, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu, by that monk. So you can imagine that if you are able to not give rise to any kind of anger or even irritation, but remain completely equanimous, if somebody attacks you with a two-handled saw, then you've got your act together, as they say here. So you can see why he says here, much has been done by that bhikkhu. And I would think to be able to do that, you have to have very powerful samadhi to be able to do that sort of thing here. Ideally, you would want to be an Arya, somebody on the path to enlightenment, to be able to do that sort of practice. Yes? Is it possible? You don't have to. I think the thing to do there is not so much. The best way to overcome this sort of thing is not to actually see it as impermanent, because that will be, you almost have to be an Arya to do that. What you do instead is to make sure your meditation is going very well. So establish yourself in good samadhi. Do some loving kindness meditation, some compassion. That is actually the best way to reduce the ill will or negativity which comes in these kind of cases. If you try to use insight practice, you're going to find it too difficult, I think, at this stage. Okay, so that is the earth element. And now, fortunately, the next three elements here, we have the water element, the fire element, and the air element. It is exactly the same same treatment of each one of these. So I'm going to go much faster for these ones. So what, friends... Maybe any more questions on this one before I move on? Because that is the main kind of part of the discourse here. Anybody want to ask anything? Any question is fine. It doesn't have to be a very smart question or anything like that. take any questions, sir. No questions. Okay. So we'll just move on then with the next three elements. What, friends, is the water element? The water element may be either internal or external. What is the internal water element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. That is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, urine, and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. This is called the internal water element. And notice here that water element even includes things which are clearly not water, like oil, for example, and grease. So the point here is not so much that it is water. The point here is that it is actually liquid, something which has a liquid consistency here. Now, both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the water element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element. And it's quite easy to see how water, how we drink, and water goes into this body and then it evaporates and it goes out again as urine. And it's very clear how water is something which is very much in continuous flux with the environment around us. And it's not very much a permanent part of this body at all. But if you take the water completely out of the body, there's almost nothing left of the body. It says 70% of the body is made up of water. Take everything out, and you're just left with this little pile of hard matter behind there. So again, they are the same, the external and the internal one, and when you see that, you become dispassionate towards the water element. Now there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed. It carries away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sinks down 100 leagues, 200 leagues, 300 leagues, 400 leagues, 500 leagues, 600 leagues, 700 leagues. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 7 palms deep, 6 palms deep, all the way down to 1 palm deep. There comes a time when the water in the great ocean stands 7 fathoms, 6 fathoms, 2 fathoms, only 1 fathom deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 0.5 fathom deep, only waist deep, only knee deep, only ankle deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great oceans are not enough to wet even the joint of a finger. When even this external water element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So again, the impermanence of the, this is just to show the impermanence of the water element, that all water sometimes disappears completely here. And then it continues just in the same way as the previous section, with being reviled, abused, and scolded, and also with being attacked, etc. And again, he reflects in the same way. When he gets reviled and scolded, he reflects that all of this is dependent on the water element. It's dependent on form, in other words. And because of that, it is all impermanent, and he doesn't react to it. The fire element. What, friend, is the fire element? The fire element may be either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. That is, that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. This is called the internal fire element. Now, both the internal fire element and the external fire element are simply fire element. And that should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the fire element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the fire element. Now, there comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed. It burns up villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. It goes out due to lack of fuel only when it comes to green grass, or to a road, or to a rock, or to water, or to a fair open space. There comes a time when they seek to make fire even with a cock's feather or a hide paring. In other words, point here is that they can't find anywhere to make a fire anymore. Fire has literally disappeared. When even this external fire element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. And then the same section again on being abused and also on being threatened with being beaten, etc. The air element. What friends is the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. That is, upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, in-breath and out-breath, and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Now, both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air element. And that should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is, with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted, or if you like, repelled with the air element, and one makes the mind dispassionate. In other words, one loses interest in the air element. Now there comes a time when the external air element is disturbed. It sweeps away villages, towns, districts, cities, and countries. There comes a time in the last month of the hot season when they seek wind by means of a fan or bellows, and even the strands of straw in the drip fringe of the thatch do not stir. When even this external air element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So again, just showing how the air element in general is impermanent, and so it is with whatever air belongs to oneself. And then again, you have the same paragraph again about being reviled and scolded and abused, and also about being threatened to be beaten. And again, you use your perceptions, your what you have learned about the elements to actually help dispelling seeing the impermanence in that abuse and scolding, etc., and not holding on to it. And then we come to the concluding section of this discourse. And friends, just as when a space is enclosed by timber and creepers, grass and clay, it comes to be termed a house, so too, when a space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be termed material form, or rather it becomes to be termed body, I think is a better translation in this particular case. So in other words, when these things come together, it becomes to be called the body. So if you add all these various parts of the body that we have seen throughout this discourse, you put them all together, you get the body. Or if you put the four elements together in a certain way, then they also become the body by putting them together in a certain way. So it's nothing more than the four elements being put together in a particular way. That is what is the body. Just like a house is a certain but building materials put together in a certain way. So now he is working himself backwards. Remember, we have gone all the way down to the individual elements, looked at each of the four individual elements, and now he's putting those four individual elements together. And so he's reversing the breakdown that he did initially, breaking down from the Four Noble Truths step by step to the individual elements. Now his Venerable Sotpa is doing the opposite. He's building up from the individual elements and going back up again to the Four Noble Truths. He's reversing the breakdown that he did initially here. And you will see that as we go through here, the last part of the sutta. So the first thing he's doing, he's then taking the four elements and putting them together and saying that these four elements put together actually is what makes up the body. This is the first thing he's saying. Yeah? And then he moves on from there and he says, if, friends, internally the eye is intact, but no external forms come into its range, and there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. If internally the eye is intact and external forms come into its range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. But when internally the eye is intact, the external forms come into its range, and there is the corresponding conscious engagement, then there is the manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. And this is what I mentioned at the beginning, that for there to be contact, there has to be three factors coming together. You have to have the eye, you have to see. There has to be the visual object that you see. And there has to be what they here call a corresponding conscious engagement. What that means is simply that you have to pay attention. That's what it means. So sometimes you can see things, you don't really pay attention to it, so you don't actually doesn't sink into the mind. But you actually have to pay attention to something. And when you pay attention, and there is an external object, and the eye is working, those three things together, then seeing happens. And that seeing is what we call contact. And that seeing is also what they here call the corresponding class of consciousness. So the corresponding class of consciousness is, of course, eye consciousness. The six types of consciousness, right? One of them is eye consciousness. So when eye is there, form is there, and you pay attention, then eye consciousness arises. That is what this passage is saying. All those three things have to be present. Does that make sense? Okay. Then he goes on and he says, the material form in what has thus come to be is included in the material form aggregate affected by clinging. The feeling in what has thus come to be is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging. The perception in what has thus come to be is included in the perception aggregate affected by clinging. The formations in what has thus come to be are included in the formations aggregate affected by clinging. The consciousness in what has thus come to be is included in the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. He understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be inclusion, gathering and amassing of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay, so what is happening here is that when he says the material form in what has thus come to be, what that means is that when you are looking and eye consciousness arises, then that which you see right there, that visual impression you have, that is the material form which has thus come to be. You're paying attention to the material form, so that arises in your mind. So that is the form aggregate at that moment, is that material form in your mind, and also may possibly also includes the eye itself. So when there is this conscious engagement between the when you actually see something, that is the form aggregate at that particular time. And of course also there is a feeling associated again with that particular seeing. Either you like it or you don't like it, or it's neutral. So there's a feeling associated with it. And that's what it means. The feeling in what has thus come to be is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging. There is a perception associated with that moment of seeing, and that is called the that is part of the perception aggregate affected by clinging. Yeah? There is a volition or intention or will or a doer, if you like, associated also with that act of seeing, because you are purposely looking in a particular direction, you're purposely paying attention to something. Yeah? So there is the mind is willing there. And that willing is part of the formation aggregate affected by clinging. Yeah? And the consciousness in what has thus come to be is included in the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. Yeah? Every time you see something, consciousness obviously also has to be present. So you can see here how all the five aggregates are part of any instance of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. They're all there, and it's impossible to have any of these sensory experiences without all the five aggregates being present every single time. So you can see now he's working himself back. He started with the individual elements. Then he shows how that relates, how that they come together to form the whole body. And then once you have a body and you have external elements as well, then the five aggregates have to arise and they come out of that. The five aggregates are part and parcel of this whole experience of the world outside. And he understands this indeed is how there comes to be the inclusion, gathering, and amassing of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay, it's two ways that we can understand this, and I think one of them is much more important than the other one. But the first way is simply to understand that whenever you have any kind of experience, then that experience conditions you. It has an effect on you. When you see something and the way you react to it, the way you feel about it, everything we experience has an effect on our mind. And because it has an effect on our mind, it conditions us, and it sort of builds up who we are, who we take ourselves to be. And that is why it says here, one reason why it says here, that this seeing, hearing, etc., it builds up the five aggregates because it builds up our sense of identity and who we are. It changes us, it conditions us, it makes us into who we are. But there's another, I think, more important way to understand this, and this is to understand that in this paragraph on top there, when it says that in number 27, that the eye has to be there, form has to be there, and there has to be the corresponding conscious engagement, that usually there is craving involved there. There is craving involved in that engagement. The reason why we see what we see, we hear what we hear, we do what we do, tends to be directed by craving. And because it is directed by craving, we are making kamma usually when we see things, when we hear things, when we do almost anything. So, of course, and when we are making kamma in a certain way, by doing things with a certain amount of craving, then we are building up the five aggregates in the sense that we are creating a rebirth for ourselves in a future life. And depending on what we see, how we see it, and how we deal with it, we're making kamma of different types, leading to different sorts of rebirth in the future. And this is what is usually meant by this sort of statement in the suttas. It occurs in a few places by the fact that you are gathering up and amassing the five aggregates in the sense that you are building bodies, you're building personalities for yourself in future lives by the way you are reacting to the outside world, by the way you are using your volition, your intention, and your mind. That is how you're building up future lives, based on craving, based on the desire to exist. So that is my interpretation of what is said there. It is not 100% explicit as it is in the suttas, but it is the way I think it makes most sense. Anybody have any questions about that? Yes, Suzu? Yeah. Sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The most important aspect of kamma to give rise to a future life is what they call the habitual kamma. What you generally do in this present lifetime is what has the most power to generate life in the future. So it is. So if you habitually enter deep meditation, well, that is very likely to take over in the future, in your next existence, because that is your habitual thing to do. Or if you habitually indulge in certain things, then that will be what brings you into your next life. The habits, it's particularly the habits in this life, which are the most power to actually change you. That is why, you know, one of the things in Buddhism is to change those habits and actually lift your mind up and to bring them to a new level, so that you actually are starting to have habits in a different way, in a different place. And when those habits change, well, that will be where you are working from instead. And that will tend to be where you get reborn in your next life. But this karma business is quite complicated. And there's also, maybe I shouldn't go too much into it because we get on a bit of sidetrack there. But of course, it can also happen that if you have some sort of bad death and you get a bit upset or something at the moment you die, then that can actually take precedent over your habitual karma, and it can take you to maybe an unhappy destination, at least for a short time, before you follow your more general karma, so to speak. But yes, it is a very important point, and I think it's a point which people often maybe don't understand properly, is that it is our general conduct which will tend to, is the most important thing in our rebirth in the future. And we are continuously building up that conduct and changing it and moving it towards that new life. And this is how it basically happens. And this is why it is so great, so good in a sense, to lead a life which is spiritual. The more spiritual your life is and the more you focus on these things, the more ability you have to actually change your conduct. And that is why it is so sad in a sense to live a life which is completely unreflective about these things. Because you're not going to go anywhere. You're just going to build up the same old karma, go to the same old destination, and you're not really going to do anything very, very useful with your life. So, yes. But anyway, I think we're getting a bit sidetracked, so I'll get back on the main theme again. So this is how there comes to be the amassing, the gathering of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging. Now, this has been said by the Blessed One. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. And these five aggregates affected by clinging are dependently arisen. And now you can understand how this particular phrase fits in. Initially, it seemed a bit baffling to me. Well, actually, why does it suddenly bring this dependent origination up here? It doesn't seem to make any sense. But the reason is, I think it's quite clearly, is that he has just been talking about how the aggregates are gathered and amassed for the future. And this is, of course, about future rebirth and about future lives. How through your cravings, when you have sensual impacts happening to you, how you're building these things up. And that, of course, is all about dependent origination. How karma, a craving from the past, gives rise to a new life in the future, a new body in the future, a new mind in the future. This is all about dependent origination. And that's why dependent origination gets brought up here. And you can see how it fits into the whole picture here. So, therefore, he brings up dependent origination. And he says that these five aggregates affected by clinging are dependently arisen. They are dependently arisen on the karma from a past life, and also dependently arisen on whatever you do in this life as well. But the most important one is the karma from a past life. And then he says the desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding, then he says based on, and I think this again is not a very good translation, this should rather read the desire for, indulgence in, inclination towards, and holding to these five aggregates, is actually the desire for these things, affected by clinging, is the origin of suffering. So, now we're bringing it all the way back to the Four Noble Truths again. This is, of course, the second Noble Truth, which talks about what the origin of suffering is. And it fits in with dependent arising, because he has just shown how karma and desire from the past gives rise to a heaping up of these five aggregates, just continuing the same thread there, basically. Yeah. Then we also have, of course, that the removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for these five aggregates affected by clinging, is the cessation of suffering. Yeah. So there you also have the third noble truth, taking away desire, take away craving, yeah, and you actually take away suffering itself. And part of this is also, of course, the path that leads to the end of suffering, because that path is what you have to practice to actually reach that point where suffering ceases and you abandon desire and lust altogether. So that brings us back to the beginning again, where he started off, back to the Four Noble Truths. So he started breaking it down all the way down to the four elements, and now he's building it back up again, back to the Four Noble Truths, to show how it all sort of holds together, and how it all depends on each other, and how it's all related to each other. So, then he says, at that point, too, bhikkhu, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. So, that's a bit rather strange thing to say, I find. Much has been done by that bhikkhu at that point. It sounds like a classical understatement. It must be a Buddhist understatement, I think. Because at that point, you would really be an arahant at that point if you had done this properly. So, this, I think, is the Buddhist beating the British in understatement. Okay, and then essentially that is really the end of the sutta, because now what happens now is that they show exactly the same thing for the other four senses. So we can go through this fairly quickly because it's basically the same thing, but maybe it will sink in a little bit deeper because it's obviously quite complicated. So I'll read it again just to see if some questions come up or whatever. So if, friends, internally the ear is intact, but no external sounds come into its range, if the nose is intact, but no external smells comes into its range, if the tongue is intact, but no external flavors come into its range, if internally the body is intact, but no external tangibles come into its range, actually the six senses, the mind is also coming in here, if, friends, internally the mind is intact, but no external mind objects come into its range, and there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. If internally the mind is intact, and external mind objects come into its range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. But when internally the mind is intact, and external mind objects do come into its range, and there is the corresponding conscious engagement, then there is manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. So again, you have to have three factors have to be there for there to be contact, for you to actually feel anything, or see anything, or hear anything, or even think anything. You have to have the mind object, and the consciousness arising. It's a little bit strange when you deal with the mind here. It's very obvious when you deal with the sense, with one of the five senses, because you can see the distinction between the eye and the object and the consciousness. But when you deal with the mind, it all becomes a little bit obscure, because even external object is a bit strange when talking about the mind, because like a thought, for example, how external is that? It seems pretty internal. But it's just a standard way of talking about this. It's basically you have a standard setup, which is very, very common in the suttas. And then you apply that standard setup to all the six senses. So that is why it becomes a little bit funny in this particular case. But the interesting point here is that even a thought, it seems to be possible to almost think, but not really be conscious of it, not really be clear about it. Things may go through the mind. Because you're not paying attention, it doesn't really register. Okay, the material form in what has thus come to be is included in the material form aggregate affected by clinging. So the material form in this case can, for example, be, even though we're just talking about the mind here, if, for example, you bring up a picture up into the mind, or you can maybe even hear something just mentally, Well, that actually is a form aggregator in the mind, but it's a mental manifestation of that form aggregator. And then that, again, will also be affect, will have a feeling that goes with it. So the feeling in what has thus come to be is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging here. The perception in what has thus come to be is included in the perception aggregate affected by clinging here. The formations or the doer in what has thus come to be here is included in the doing aggregate affected by clinging here. The consciousness in what has thus come to be is included in the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging here. So all the mental aggregates and also the form aggregate, they're all present at each of these times when you have mental experiences. He understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be inclusion, gathering and amassing of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging here. In other words, because of that desire which make you think in certain ways, which make you pay attention to certain thoughts, make you pay attention to certain mental objects, because of that desire, that craving, you make kamma, and because you're making kamma, you are building up five aggregates into future lives. Now, this has been said by the Blessed One, one who understands this process, this dependent origination, the process of how craving gives rise to aggregates in the future. He sees the Dhamma, and one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. He sees this process. That, of course, is the Sotapanna who has seen the Dhamma. So Sotapanna understands dependent origination. He understands the process by which craving gives rise to future lives. And these five aggregates affected by clinging are dependently arisen. The desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding to these five aggregates affected by clinging is the origin of suffering here. Craving is the origin of suffering here. The removal of desire, lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for these five aggregates affected by clinging is the cessation of suffering. Third noble truth, the fourth noble truth being implied because it is the path leading to this. At that point, too, friends, much has been done by that monk here. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Okay, any more questions or comments anybody has? Yes, sir. No, it's anything in the mind, any object of the mind. So it can be, you know, it can be just a sense of happiness, for example, if you are happy. That happiness in the mind is also a mind object. That's what we talk about samadhi practice is. Yes, but it's also the object at the same time. It's in many things, that this is the whole point, that any particular instant of any kind of object, whether it's the sight or the sound or even the mind, has all these aspects to it. Depends on which angle you see it, you see. Yeah. It's like a sound. There's feeling, perception, there's a physical thing, there's consciousness, there's also the will, they're all present. And the same thing with the mind. You feel happiness, but that's why they're called the jhanas, for example. The jhanas are called rupa jhanas, because there is a certain material aspect still to that happiness you have in the mind. It's not completely disassociated from matter yet. It's only when you get to the rupa states that it's completely disassociated. You may not be able to know what that is until you get to the rupa states, but there's still some form there. Huh? And yeah, okay. Any more questions? Comments? Anybody? Yeah. Any complaints? Okay, let's pay our homage to the triple gem then.